You're listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schindelheim, Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Work in Progress explores the rapidly changing workplace through conversations with innovators, educators, and decision-makers, people with solutions to today's workforce challenges. Analytics are playing a big role in understanding the spread of COVID-19 and in making decisions on how we should respond to the disease to prevent it from spreading further. Joining me now to discuss how data analysis is being used in the decision-making by governments and health officials is Eric Bradlow, professor and vice dean of analytics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Eric, thank you for joining me.
Oh, Ramona, it's great to be with you.
It's been 4 months since we heard the first reports from China about what we now know as COVID-19. What role is data analytics playing in our understanding of the disease?
Well, I think there are two sides. Obviously, there's the, if you'd like, biological and medicine side, which is, although we'll talk in a second about how data analytics could help find a vaccine and cures for it, there's really two parts. One would be really the spread of the disease is all data analytics. In other words, what you really need to know is what is the spread rate? So what fraction of people exposed to it actually get the virus, and actually then there's the rate of for which people show symptoms. Obviously, there's the rate at which people have serious complications. And then, of course, unfortunately, there's the rate of death. And so what's interesting about these, if you'd like, data analytic mathematical systems is these are classic what we call in the literature diffusion models. How do things diffuse across a population? And so there's a small number of things you need to know. And from that, you can kind of forecast out what the number of, if you'd like, the number of positive tests, the number of people that will have complications, the death rate, et cetera, over time.
Is this data coming in from one source? Is it a compilation? Everybody working together? Who's providing the base for this?
It's a great question. Here's the problem. The problem is, matter of fact, one of my favorite talks to give, and I have a, if you go Eric Bradlow on YouTube, you can see me present about this. There's data and then there's good data. The problem is this is not great data. And let me say why. First of all, we actually don't know exactly the number of people that are being tested. Number two, we don't know the accuracy of these tests. I'm sure you've heard the terms before, false positive, false negative rates. So in this case, someone goes in, whether it's a nasal swab, antibody test, et cetera, it says you have the COVID-19 virus. Well, do you actually? It's not 100% accurate. Or it says you don't have it. That's a false negative. And of course, that's the one that's extraordinarily serious for society, is that you think you don't have it and you might, and you get in contact with other people and you spread it. And then, of course, there's all kinds of other issues that the data we have isn't a random sample, which means we're seeing the data from people that are very sick. This is not your classic unbiased sample. And so while we have data, while all of the mathematical models we're hearing about are showing data from different sources, none of them is the kind of, if you like, clean, unbiased data a statistician would love to have to do this estimation.
And then you have to have someone analyze it and then present those findings to officials, health officials, government officials, then to make decisions, kind of projecting them out. Is this going to continue to spread this way?
To me, statistical models, data analytics, they're a decision support tool. They're not meant to replace decision makers. They're meant to support decision makers. So at the end of the day, I'm sure you've thought about this personally. I've thought about this personally. There's going to have to be a trade-off, which means the death rate is not going to go to zero anytime soon. The, if you like, complication rate is not going to zero. The probability of spreading is not going to zero. So at some point, we're all going to have to weigh, you know, do you open up the economy? Do we each as individuals put ourselves under risk? And so, you know, this is the classic trade-off that has to be made. I'm not being political here. It's the classic trade-off between increased spreading and, of course, loss of income and other things versus health and well-being on the other side. And it is a numbers game, which is, you know, as you tilt one direction, you increase one side. And as you tilt another direction, you increase another side. And if I were a philosophy professor as opposed to a marketing and statistics professor, I could tell you societally what weight to put on each. But that's an individual's decision.
that same data analysis is likely being used by businesses now, I would think, on, you know, weighing whether to let people go and how long, and is it a furlough or a layoff, and when do you bring them back?
Yeah, so I mean, every business is going to have to deal with this issue because, for example, give a personal example, my oldest son works for Disney. And you think of how Disney makes money, a large fraction of its revenue is from theme parks, hotels, cruise ships, movie theaters, etc. That may be some of the last things to come back. And so what every company is having to decide upon is the whole is the sum of its parts. So there might be some parts of any company's revenue that could come back quickly. Like, for example, if you're an e-commerce retailer, you may be actually selling more online now than you did before. So that part of your business is happy. The brick and mortar part of your business might be a lot less happy. So now the question is, you know, when things come back, at what rate are they going to come back? What fraction of people are going to come back into physical stores? Matter of fact, this is one of those things, Ramona, back to your earlier question, policymakers might say you can only have 25% of the capacity in your physical store. Well, unless people are going to quadruple the amount that they spend, you're going to bring in less revenue in the physical store. So you're right. There's no question every business is going to be thinking about full-time layoffs versus furloughs, et cetera. But at the end of the day, most businesses have multiple revenue streams and they're going to come back at very different rates, some of which may even increase or stay higher in the future. As an example, I never used food delivery to my home prior to this COVID-19 situation. I've now started using it. Maybe this is what we talk about in marketing and business all the time. It's called product trial. Now that I've tried it, maybe I'll spend less time going to the physical supermarket in the future and I'll stay a loyal online food buyer. So a lot of businesses are going to have to deal with now that people are used to a different norm, they may actually do something different in the future.
A corporation probably already have a full-time staff that looks at all these decision makings, but you know, mom and pop store, that would seem like it'd be more trial and error.
Yeah, it's a great point you bring up. I think, you know, one of the words that we all have to remember in these times is heterogeneity. And what I mean by that is every business is going to be affected differentially. We already see some states are hot spots. Some states aren't having as much, if you'd like, spread and death rate. Every individual may be affected differently. There's no question, I agree with you, that small businesses, number one, they don't have the cash reserves. As I don't know if you know this statistic, but 90% of companies that go out of business because of cash flow issues. It's not because they don't have a good business idea, but they run out of cash. You could easily imagine, despite the government's efforts, lots of small businesses could be, if you'd like, their businesses mortally affected by this cash flow. And you're right. They don't have, I'll call it the systematic, what we call A/B testing or, you know, kind of, let's try this. It's not how a lot of small businesses operate. And so one of the things I would recommend to any small business that's listening to the podcast is make sure you figure out, you collect data, make sure you figure out which things you're doing are leading to increased versus decreased revenue, because that's your best opportunity. Be a what I call a learning organization and learn what's working in the new reality versus not.
All these stay-at-home orders are also causing changes not only in the way we work, live, spend our money, but also the way we're learning. Is there a way to use the data analytics to look at whether, you know, online or offline education is going to be the norm moving forward?
As a university professor, this is what we think about all the time. I joke about the following. If you had asked most professors like myself 3 months ago, would you prefer online teaching or offline teaching or, you know, brick and mortar teaching? They would say, you mean I could sit in my home? I could be in my pajamas and teach and I could, you know, this, that. Most people would have said, well, of course I want that. But I don't think there's many people that are saying that now. You lose the energy of the classroom. You lose the face-to-face interaction. You lose the ability to have students interact with each other. So I think this has taught us a lot about what can be effectively taught online versus what still there is a tremendous value in physical interaction, brick and mortar classrooms, etc. I think it's going to shift things a lot. I go back to my issue of trial. There probably were many learners, and I don't mean just college students. I mean kids from age 2 to 92 who never thought that much about online education, despite it being a big business for the last 10 years, who are now exposed to it, who may transfer certain parts of their educational experience to an online one. So I think there's going to be even increased pressure on brick and mortar universities like mine, the University of Pennsylvania, but all around the world, to actually deliver greater value as people are now exposed to the positives and negatives of online education.
You know, we see, and we've talked about this at Working Nation for a while, the power of data analytics as a career and as a future of work career. And it's really playing out now. We're seeing how important that is. Tell me a little bit what you think about the future of data analytics as a career.
Well, obviously, you're talking, as you mentioned in your introduction to me, which was very kind, that I'm the Vice Dean of Analytics at the Wharton School. So I've obviously drank the analytics Kool-Aid for a very long time. I believe it is one of the jobs that is kind of, if you like, it's recession-proof. Every industry needs people that can learn how to ingest data, analyze data, help companies make business decisions through data. It's a set of skills that you would think, wow, you hear all these people doing data science. No, there's actually a shortage of people that can do data science. And so as data science becomes a deeper and even more rich field, I think even more companies are going to have need for data scientists. And also, I think it's, I know it's a lot of the work you do at Working Nation. I'm not convinced that it's something that you have to have a 4-year full-time degree on. There's no reason you can't. Matter of fact, a lot of companies offer this. You can get a certificate in data science. You can take online courses in data science. You can do part-time work in data science. And I know many people, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s that are starting to get into data science. So it's not just a young person's game. And so to me, it's the future of many businesses. It can be done as a part-time job. It's something that can be learned. There's a lot of online opportunities and offline opportunities to do so. And I'm hoping it's seen as one of those, as I said, recession-proof types of opportunities, as long as the person is willing to take their skills and apply them to lots of different industries.
And Eric, before we go, I would be remiss if I didn't talk to you about sports. You're the host of Wharton Moneyball on SiriusXM. And for baseball fans such as myself, this is a very strange time. You know, it's the beginning of May and we've not seen any baseball, but we saw the end of the NBA season early. What can you tell me about how statistics is playing a role in deciding, is sports going to start up again?
So that's a great question. It depends what you mean by sports start up again. Like if what you mean is the following, you said you were a baseball fan. I know you said you were earlier to me offline. You said you were a Cubs fan. We can start baseball tomorrow. Here's all we have to do. And I'm sure you've read about this. We have to take all the major league players. We first have to test them for COVID-19. And by the way, as I mentioned earlier, we better test them multiple times each because there could be false positives and false negatives. Then all we do is we put them in a controlled environment where they can't see anybody, meaning they can't go home to their families. They can't all, let's, you know, put them in a bubble dome and then start playing the games. And so if you want that and then don't have any fans in the stadium when the games happen, if you want that baseball experience and the MLB Players Association is willing to allow that, we can have baseball back by the end of this month. The thing is, do people want to watch baseball with no fans? Do players want to essentially be sequestered for the season? And by the way, this is not just the MLB. In theory, you could do this in the NFL, you could do this in the NBA, you could do this in the NHL. But that's going to be a very different product that is going to be played. And then the question is, do people want to watch? Because as you know, most of the money now in Major League Baseball and these sports isn't made by selling tickets. It's made from the distribution rights and the online and the TV rights. So will people still watch? Will advertisers still spend money on shows where there are no fans in the seats? And then another last topic that we talk about on Wharton Moneyball all the time is what happens to the level of play? Do you know, players not get as excited when they're not playing in front of fans? So does the work product itself actually suffer? So I'm with you as a sports fan. I cannot imagine, I could never have imagined that none of our sports would be running right now. And I'm ready to, this way, I hope they choose to sequester themselves because I'm ready to watch some sports.
I am too, but you just brought up something that's really interesting that I've thought about, but not in terms of this right now. I love the sound of the fans as they watch a baseball very close to the foul pole, and either it's a home run or a foul ball, you know, that collective crowd reaction. I can't imagine that it doesn't, as you put it, amp up a player, you know, when they're out there, when they're performing.
Yeah, a couple things we've talked about on Wharton Moneyball is, number one, what happens to player performance? Maybe it goes down. Two, back to my concept of heterogeneity, maybe it has no impact on the superstar like LeBron James, but it has, or on Mike Trout, or, you know, on one of those players, but it has an impact on the lower level players. That's possible. Another thing we've talked about is, you know, one of the big things in baseball, you being a Cubs fan, there's no better home field advantage than Wrigley Field. Well, is there a home field advantage when there are no crowd in the seats? Do you lose home field advantage, or, you know, do you even play games at Wrigley Field? You know, if you use my dome example, we're probably playing at some Arizona neutral stadium.
Yeah, right. I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's going to affect player performance. I think it's going to affect home field advantage. I think it's going to affect the work product on the field. But at the end of the day, you know what they say? Right now, we ain't got nothing. So I think both of us would take baseball, some baseball, Major League Baseball, even with no crowds. It's not optimal, but at the end of the day, we want everyone to be safe.
Exactly. And to that point, when the NBA ended its season, there was a lot of people peripherally who, not even peripherally, directly, who lost their jobs, the vendors, the stadium ushers, the, you know, people who do all the home stands. So if everybody played in Arizona, all the people in Chicago wouldn't be going back to work this season.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up another fantastic point, which is whenever there are these transformative type of disruptions, of which COVID-19 is one, you think about all the industries that are impacted. And so, as you mentioned, not just the vendors, but what about all the restaurants near the stadiums? And what about all the Uber and Lyft drivers that are taking people to the stadiums? I like to think of it as a set of concentric circles. You start going out from, okay, well, there's all the people directly affected. And then there's the people that are sort of indirectly. And then you keep going out. And by the time you're done, you might have 20, 25 million people in the workforce that are affected by what appears to be, you know, it's just baseball. Yeah, well, yeah, but there's the business of baseball. And so you're right. The impact is much greater than just the product on the field. It's all the people whose jobs are collaterally affected.
Eric Bradlow, the host of Wharton Moneyball on Sirius XM, and the Vice Dean of Analytics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Work in Progress. I'm Ramona Schundelheim, the Editor-in-Chief of Working Nation. Our producer is Larry Buell. Our executive producers are Joan Lynch and Melissa Panzer. Thank you for listening.